Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, the more margin you have, and the more money you keep. So to reduce costs, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. Over 70,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/GPS. netsuite.com/GPS.
This is GPS, the global public square. Welcome to all of you in the United States and around the world. I'm Fareed Zakaria, coming to you live from New York. We are going to get right into it this morning as we await the next release of hostages from Gaza. Israel and Hamas are now 2 days and 10 hours into their four-day truce. On Friday, 13 Israelis and 11 foreign nationals were released from captivity in Gaza. Yesterday, after a long delay, another 13 Israelis and 4 foreigners were released. That brings the total to 26 Israelis and 15 foreigners who have been freed during the truce. On the flip side of this arrangement, 39 Palestinians were released from Israeli prisons on Friday and 39 again on Saturday. Another major aspect of the deal was getting aid into Gaza, and hundreds of trucks filled with food, water, fuel, medical supplies and more have crossed into the territory since the truce began on Friday. Let me bring in CNN's Oren Lieberman, who is in Tel Aviv for us with the latest. Oren, I wanted to ask you, the truces previously over the years between Hamas and the Israeli government have often been fraught with difficulty. What was the delay yesterday, and is that portentous? Does that tell us that this fragile truce might actually collapse?
So first, let's look at where we stand today. We are expecting and anticipating that the movement and the transfer of Israeli hostages from the hands of Hamas to the Red Cross should or could begin sometime soon. It was 2 days ago in the first transfer of hostages that it had already begun. But as we know, yesterday was a very different story, and that is where it was fraught with difficulties and at risk of falling apart. So yesterday, Hamas complained that Israel was not living up to its side of the bargain, that all of the aid trucks hadn't gotten in, and crucially, that they hadn't gotten to northern Gaza, which Israel has still called an active war zone. That led to a massive hours-long delay and fear amongst all the parties involved here, and not just Israel and Hamas, but also the Qataris and the Americans, that the deal itself may fall apart. There was an intensive diplomatic effort there to make sure that it remained together. On the Israeli side, Israel also accused Hamas of violating the terms of the agreement because there was a child released without a mother, and the agreement was to keep families together. So perhaps not surprising at all that we see accusations going back and forth of violating the terms of the agreement. What is crucial, though, Fareed, is that the agreement held and the transfer happened. In addition, Hamas also released some foreign nationals for the second time tomorrow. Now we're waiting to see, and so far it looks like it is moving forward again, and we are waiting to see when the transfer once again begins of more Israeli hostages coming out of Gaza, and then subsequently more Palestinian prisoners released from Israeli jails, women and children on both sides of that agreement. We have no reason to believe at this point that today's transfer is at risk, but we shall see, Fareed.
Oren, is there any indication as to whether there is a logic to the foreign nationals being released? Are they prioritizing Israelis? Do Americans, are they top priority at the bottom of the list? Do we have any sense of this, or is it sort of random?
From what we can tell, it's sort of random. For example, the youngest in captivity, 10-month-old Kfir Bibas and his family, remains in captivity. There were some who expected maybe they come out first simply based on age and the family comes out. That simply is not the case, and that family whom we spoke with a short time ago says they've got no information at all that they'll be part of tonight's release. Meanwhile, the foreign nationals, at least as Hamas is trying to portray it, are essentially an extra. There's nothing in exchange for them. They're simply being released. They, of course, are not part of this conflict in any way, not part of this war. So they're being released on what appears to be a random basis, 10 Thais and a Filipino on the first night, 4 more Thai nationals last night. So we'll see. But even on the Israeli side, there doesn't appear to be any rhyme or reason to it. And then today to learn, we're expecting our first American release. There are at least two others we expect as part of the women and children. But there doesn't appear to be any way to look at a list and say, okay, these people are coming out now until Hamas releases that list.
Oren Lieberman, thank you so much. Thanks for your great reporting. I want to now bring in Amir Tibon. He is diplomatic correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He was also a resident of one of the kibbutzes that was attacked on October 7th. The pictures you're seeing on your screen are Amir's house. He and his family spent 10 hours locked in their safe room during the attack, only to be saved by Amir's father, a former IDF general. Amir believes that today's release of hostages will include residents of his kibbutz, Nahal Oz. Amir, pleasure to have you on. Let me first ask you, what does it feel like? I know you're right there, because there must be mixed feelings. Some people are being released, but others apparently will not be from this kibbutz, right?
Hi, Farid. Thank you so much for having me. Right now, there is, first of all, a lot of anxiety and suspense because we don't know what is going to happen. Last night, there was supposed to be a release in the early evening hours here in Israel of 13 of our hostages from a neighboring community to ours. And eventually, they only got out around 11 p.m. because Hamas pulled a list of dirty and vicious and really cruel tricks to try to delay and postpone and buy time. And we want to see, first and foremost, that today's list of 13 people actually come out and get to meet their families. And we here in my community are expecting some news, but I don't want to say anything beyond that right now because everything is very, very delicate. I will just say we are, as a community, going through a very difficult period since October 7th. We're trying to hold one another, support one another, stay together. And this is what we're going to do today as well. Just be there for one another and hope for good news.
Amir, let me ask you, if I may, to put your hat on. You're a distinguished diplomatic correspondent. What is your sense of the prospects of this ceasefire being extended? There are people talking. President Biden has said there's a chance. Do you think the Israeli government would accept that? It seems to me, from the initial rhetoric, highly unlikely, because the Israeli government has said they want to get rid of Hamas, and surely that has not yet been done.
Farid, Israel is facing an impossible dilemma at this moment. We have no good choices. We only have terrible choices in the current situation. On the one hand, even after the very, very exciting and wonderful releases of two groups of hostages last night and the night before, we still have approximately 200 people in the hands of the enemy. The vast majority of them are civilians, including more women, more children. And our first priority is to get them out, to bring them home after more than 50 days in the tunnels of Gaza, in the hands of ruthless terrorists. Some of these, the hostages, before they were kidnapped, their own family members were murdered before their eyes. So our first priority is to bring them back. And I do believe if there is a possibility to prolong the current ceasefire in return for the release of more hostages, Israel will be willing to discuss it. I know President Biden is pushing for it. I know Secretary Blinken is working for it, and other countries in the region, Qatar, Egypt. However, we should not be mistaken to think that a long-term ceasefire ending the war is in the cards right now. It is not. Israel has been fighting against Hamas now for 50 days. There's been a lot of achievements for the Israeli military in the northern part of Gaza, but Hamas is still barricading itself in the southern part of Gaza among the civilian population over there. It still has capabilities there that, if left intact, will be used to slaughter Israeli citizens again in the future. So while I do see a chance for prolonging this ceasefire by a few more days to allow the release of more hostages, I would not put my money right now on a long-term ceasefire as long as Hamas remains part of the picture.
And Amir, let me ask you, Haaretz is legendarily kind of left-of-center publication, has been very supportive of a two-state solution, the peace process. My guess is the kibbutz that you're from is also probably more in that camp than Prime Minister Netanyahu's camp. How do you, has this changed your view of the world? Does it give, just reflect, of, if you will, on what this has done for you politically and psychologically?
I have to say, Farid, as a resident of Kibbutz Nachal Oz for several years before October 7, I never had any illusions about Hamas, and neither did my neighbors. We chose to live in this community directly on the border and face the threat of mortar attacks and rocket attacks. And you know, Farid, in Kibbutz Nachal Oz and other border communities, there is no Iron Dome. We are so close to Gaza that Iron Dome does not protect us. So we never had any illusions about Hamas. We knew every day that there were people on the other side of the border who wanted to murder us. And I think from my point of view, what maybe has changed is the question of how much support does Hamas have among civilian population? Because more than the Hamas terrorists who entered our community on that morning and murdered 14 people and tried to murder me and my family, I think the more shocking issue was the fact that later civilians from Gaza came in and looted homes, and some of them took part in terrible, violent, barbaric actions. That is the real question that we must present to ourselves. And I think in general in Israel today, anybody who's not doing some self-reflection is didn't get the memo. This is true for people who are talking about long-term peace with Gaza, and it's just as true for supporters of the prime minister, who for 15 years had this idea of working with Hamas hand in hand and building Hamas as an alternative to the Palestinian Authority and supporting the Qatari payments of cash money to Hamas. We all have now a moment in this country where we need to look back at mistakes of the past, reflect on where we had been wrong. It's true, I can tell you for me personally. Sadly, while I do see this process in my own environment, I have not seen it at all right now from the political leadership of the country, which is still stuck in October 6th and did not understand perhaps what has changed.
Amir Tibon, thank you so much. I know it's a busy and complicated day for you, and we're very grateful that you took the time. Next on GPS, we'll look at the other releases during the truce, Palestinians from Israeli prisons. These releases are highly charged on both sides of the border wall. Find out why when we come back.
This podcast is supported by NetSuite. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit from NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/GPS. netsuite.com/GPS.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas in Gaza and the alleged mastermind of the October 7th attack, spent some two decades in Israeli prisons. He was released in 2011 in an extraordinary swap with Israel. At the time, Israel traded more than 1,000 Palestinians for just one Israeli, a soldier named Gilad Shalit. So the release of Palestinians from Israeli detention is a sensitive subject for Israelis and an equally charged one for Palestinians. The head of the Palestinian Commission for Detainees and Ex-Prisoners Affairs told CNN that some 8,300 Palestinians are being held in Israeli jails and that more than 3,000 of them are being held under what Israel calls administrative detention. The Palestinians said this means they are being held without knowing the charges against them and without any ongoing legal process. CNN's Nada Bashir joins me now from Jerusalem with more. Nada, explain what that means. The Palestinians point to these prisoners as a kind of proof of the very dual system that they live under in places like the West Bank and Gaza. Explain who these people are who are being released.
Absolutely, Fareed. We have seen this issue of many Palestinians, particularly in the occupied West Bank, and particularly teenagers, children under the age of 18, being detained often for months on end, sometimes even longer, without any knowledge of what they are being charged with, without access to legal representation, without an ongoing legal process. That is the system termed as administrative detention. And as we have seen over the last 2 days, many of those people released, including many teenage boys under the age of 18, many of them between the ages of 16 and 18, rather, have been held for months under administrative detention, unclear what charges they have faced. And of course, this has been an issue long before October 7th, and this continues to be an issue. We are still seeing the arrests and detentions of Palestinians, particularly in the occupied West Bank. Now, as we understand it, some 150 people, Palestinians, will be released as part of this exchange agreement, as part of that truce agreement between Israel and Hamas. And earlier in the week, we saw a list issued by Israeli authorities, a list of 300 names, women and children, who would be eligible for possible release as part of this agreement, many of them in that list under administrative detention. Of course, the Israeli authorities say some of those on that list were charged with more serious offenses, including the possession of weapons, including threatening regional security, some associated with terrorist activities, according to the Israeli authorities. But amongst those charges in that list, one of the most common was throwing stones at Israeli soldiers and risking regional security. And that is, of course, something that we have seen over the last 2 days in terms of the people that are being released. We've seen those crowds swelling around the occupied West Bank, particularly around Ramallah, to welcome the release of these detainees and prisoners. Yesterday, we saw some 33 teenage boys being released. The majority of them, again, were held under administrative detention. Many of them said that they had no idea until the early hours of yesterday morning that they would be amongst those released. And you can imagine the relief for many of those families now waiting to hear today if they will see their loved ones, their children released on this third day of that truce.
Thank you so much, Nada. Pleasure to hear you. Joining me now is Shibli Talhami. He is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He's also a senior fellow at Brookings. Shibli, welcome. Tell us how this is playing in the Arab world. You're a scholar of the Arab world. You've studied public opinion there for decades. The conventional wisdom had been for a while that, you know, while Arab leaders mouth support for this, while even the Arab street gets riled up, people don't really care. It's an issue that, you know, look at the Gulf Arabs making peace with Israel. What is going on now? What are you sensing?
Well, first of all, good to join you again, Fareed. And it's nice to see some of the hostages come home. I feel happy for the Israeli families who have loved ones, and for the Palestinian families who are rejoined with their loved ones. Let me just, if you don't mind, just briefly address the prisoner issue, because this is the issue of the day, and I'll then talk about how that plays out in the Arab world. The reason for it is that this prisoner issue, obviously, it's very, very dear to the Israelis. You could see how happy they are with the release of some of the hostages. Hopefully, all of them will be released. But this issue is so critical to Palestinians and Arabs broadly for three reasons. The one reason is the scale of it. Since the occupation started, it's estimated that a million Palestinians, remember, this is a population of 5 million people in the West Bank and Gaza, a million Palestinians have been held, many of them, as your reporter had suggested, without charges. There isn't a family that's not touched by that. So the scale of it is enormous. It's very difficult. The second is what you alluded to, the two-tiered system in the West Bank, where obviously Palestinians are under occupation. Those can be arrested by the military without charges or on called terrorists. Some of them may have carried out something that would match a terrorist label based on international definition of attacking civilians. Many of them don't. Sometimes it's a speech almost 100% conviction rate in military courts. Right next door, you have Israeli settlers who are living there illegally under international law. But if they commit a crime against Palestinians, they're rarely charged, even when there is a death of a Palestinian, and certainly convicted. So you have that tiered system that rubs deeply into the situation. The third one is that this idea of what violence is. We think of violence, particularly in the West, when we're thinking about let's reduce violence, let's make sure it doesn't erupt. We're thinking about, you know, explosions and shootings. Obviously, those are horrible, like we've seen, and they ought to stop. But the reality of the everyday, the reality of occupation, the fact that you can have a military going into somebody's home at 4 o'clock in the morning, arrest them without recourse, that is a violent act. So the gun is always present for a lifetime for most Palestinians. Even when the gun is not fired, it's always there. Occupation is a violent reality. That is the reality of everyday life for most Palestinians. And when Pete, let's go back to normal, there is no normal. Normal is violence. Normal is a violent, subtle violence, but violence nonetheless. But in the Arab world, this issue obviously resonates. What we have seen, certainly in the public opinion polling, we haven't really seen new public opinion polling, but before, obviously the Palestinian issue resonated with Arab publics, but not so much with governments, and governments have not paid much attention to it. They thought that publics don't care as much about it. But this particular episode, I think, has not only resonated in the Arab world, it has probably created a transformative paradigm-forming moment. This is not simply a moment of anger. This is a moment, I think, where the shaping of an entire, the opinion of an entire new generation that is likely to last. And it's implicating the U.S. in a direct way with the possibilities, and I hope not, but the possibilities of blowback, because they see the scale of the attack, you know, the equivalent of more than 200 nuclear devices over a period of a month and a half in a very small area with thousands of children killed, over 1.5 million displaced. They can't understand how the U.S. would be okay with that. And so, yes, I think this has generated tremendous transformation in public opinion. Now, obviously, it doesn't shift the strategic interests of the Arab states. That remains to be seen. But I think it obviously will restrain what Arab governments can do.
Do you think there's a possibility that a place like Bahrain, for example, which has a, you know, a large Shia population, may decide that it has to suspend the Abraham Accords? Do you think that Saudi Arabia will delay normalization for indefinitely?
It's really impossible to know, Fareed. Let me tell you why. I think we all kind of say, well, let's wait until this war is over. I'm not sure what that means, honestly, whether this war, quote, will be over. I'm not sure what destroying Hamas means other than destroying all of Gaza. I'm not sure whether there's going to be a moment where we say this is a moment of an opportunity. I think there is goals that had been set here that cannot really be met. By the United States, not just the Israelis. Now, the Israelis, you can understand, you know, when you have a horrific attack like the one by Hamas, hearts harden, and Palestinian hearts harden when they watch what the Israelis and feel what the Israelis are doing. You have an urge for vengeance. You have demonization. You want to do the maximum damage to the other. That's understandable. But what I can't really understand is how our own government, the United States government, has given a blank check in a matter that impacts our own national interests, not only with blowback, but the possible escalation.
I have to let it rest there. We are out of time. I really thank you, and we will of course have you back for your insights. Pleasure to have you on. Next on GPS, we will go even bigger picture and try to put the entire war in perspective. Richard Haass and Robin Wright join me to give us their wisdom. I want to pull back now with two guests who will help us think about the bigger picture of this truce, the war, and the politics of the region. Richard Haass is a former top State Department official and the President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. Robin Wright is a contributing writer at The New Yorker, a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center, and has covered the region for decades. Robin, let me start with you. You know Iran so well, and the thing that I've been struck by in all of this, you know, sometimes as Sherlock Holmes said, you have to pay attention to the dog that doesn't bark. Iran has been very restrained. Hezbollah has been fairly restrained. Nasrallah's speech basically said, we wish you well, but don't expect too much help from us. What do you think the calculation is there?
This is Hamas's war, and from the beginning, both Hezbollah and Iran have indicated that they're not going to get engaged. If this had been a joint operation, Hezbollah has far more weaponry, several times the size of Hamas arsenal. It would have been catastrophic for Israel. And it's very interesting that Hamas kept this apparently so within its own leadership in terms of when they were going to do, what they were going to do specifically, that it didn't share even with some of its own leadership outside the country. This is not a good moment for Iran to engage in a war, given its own problems at home with protests. It has its own election next year. Hezbollah also is in a very different state than it was in 2006 when it launched an operation against Israel that led to a 34-day war, now the second longest war that Israel has fought. Lebanon is a failing state. Hezbollah is a major political player. It has to care about its constituency. And it's also at a point that it doesn't have any guarantees that Iran would be there to rearm, restock, and rebuild Lebanon. So at the moment, barring unintended consequences or a wild card event, it looks like they are not going to provide the kind of help that Hamas had hoped, once it launched its offensive, that both would intervene and make it a broader region-wide war.
Richard, what are your thoughts on Iran's role here? Because it does also suggest that Hamas is a little bit more independent of Iran than people had made it out. You know, it's always been true that Hezbollah, a Shiite organization that swears fealty to the supreme leader of Iran, is very different from Hamas, which is a Sunni organization that actually supported Hamas and Iran were on the opposite sides of the Syrian civil war. So does it suggest there's more distance? How do you read what's going on?
I agree, Fareed, with both what you said and what Robin said. I think one has to distinguish between Iran's strategic support for Hamas and its tactical support. And the latter seems to have been missing in the case of this raid. For all we know, Hamas was worried that if it ran this idea by Iran, it would have been vetoed. This was very much Hamas's, October 7th was very much for Hamas to basically say their version of station identification. We are the only force in the Palestinian world willing and able to take on Israel. Iran, you know, also has all sorts of economic problems right now. They're exporting roughly 2 million barrels of oil a day. Not clear to me they want to see that interrupted. Neither does China, its principal, the country that gets most of Iran's exported oil. So, yeah, but I take your point. I think this suggests that we use the phrase proxy a little bit too loosely. And there's a degree of autonomy. I wouldn't call it independence, but a degree of autonomy, particularly when it comes to tactical decisions.
Robin, what are your thoughts on this issue of the possibility of this spreading in different ways? Are there other actors in the region who you think could get in? People have talked about, you know, the Houthis in Yemen, but it feels to me what we're seeing is a fairly classic contained Israeli-Palestinian war.
So far contained, but what we are seeing is some of Iran's proxies, like the Houthis in Yemen, some of the proxies in Iraq and Syria, taking on, in one case, Houthis taking on Israel or, in one case, the U.S. But what's more important is Iran's proxies are taking on Americans who are fighting in a different war. Those Americans, 900 in Syria, 2,500 in Iraq, who are still deployed there as part of the anti-ISIS campaign to try to make sure that ISIS does not make a comeback, can't rebuild the caliphate and challenge the governments in Iraq or in Syria. So it's very interesting how Iran is gaming this very shrewdly, tactically, taking on the American presence in the Middle East more broadly, to try to suggest that the cost of deploying. Now, the one great danger down the road is that the United States is deploying, and 2,000 troops, we're not sure where, probably some in Jordan, but the United States is not giving us full disclosure, as well as warships. And the great danger is that the United States is there to flex its muscles and to say, don't widen this war, but at the same time become targets for extremist groups, even lone wolves. And that's one of those wild cards that who knows what the unintended consequences of that kind of action might be.
Stay with us. When we come back, I'm going to ask Richard Haass about Bibi Netanyahu's lousy options and Joe Biden's lousy options. Ask him what he would do if he were in either one's shoes.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
We are back with Richard Haass and Robin Wright. Richard, let me ask you about Bibi Netanyahu. Does he have the right military strategy right now? And does he have the right political strategy? I must confess the latter, I'm not even sure he's articulated, but I wanted to know what you think is going on.
He has a military strategy, I would argue, and so would all the generals I've talked to say it's the wrong one. He doesn't have the wrong political strategy, Fareed. He doesn't have a political strategy. I think in the short run, he needs to focus on getting the hostages back. That is clearly the priority for the Israeli public. If and when he returns to military operations, it's got to be far, far more granular and discreet. It can't be these large campaigns dropping large bombs that are killing large numbers of civilians. It's just the wrong way to go about it. It's losing to American and international opinion. It's alienating Palestinians. It's a great recruiting tool for Hamas and other radical groups. And at some point, he has got to introduce a political dimension. You can't have simply a military effort against Hamas. You've got to have a political alternative. You've got to be able to say to Palestinians, look, violence is a dead end. You will never get what you want politically through violence, but there is an alternative, better way. There is a way through compromise and coexistence with Israel. Bibi has to introduce that. That's where, by the way, where I think President Biden can come in. I've been advocating that the president go to Jerusalem again, speak from the Knesset over the head of this prime minister and government, go to the Israeli people, make the case for a two-state solution. And he might want to make one stop on the way, and that is to resurrect the Saudi initiative. As you and Robin both know, one of the reasons that Hamas started this war on October 7th was to derail normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. I think the time has come to put that back on the table, to basically trigger a debate within Israel. Look, Israel, have a choice. A greater Israel with all your settlements, not giving the Palestinians a state of their own, or a greater peace, including a peace with the country, Saudi Arabia, that is pivotal in the Arab and Islamic world. So I think the United States, with Saudi Arabia as a partner, can introduce the political track that this government under Bibi Netanyahu is sorely and conspicuously lacking.
Richard, you know Israel well. They are traumatized. And I think the Israeli argument would be, look, we tried peace. Barak made an offer to Arafat. He turned it down. Olmert made an offer to Abu Mazen. He turned it down. We are stuck with these lousy options because we don't have a partner. How do you break that logjam?
Look, people are right to be suspicious. I've been involved in many of those unsuccessful attempts myself. One is to very much make it an Arab world, not as an alternative to the Palestinians, but with them. Too much in the past, we've worked with the Palestinians alone, historically, Fareed, say under the Clinton administration. More recently, with the Abraham Accords, we've only worked with the Arab world, with the governments. I actually think we need to do the two together. And look, I understand the Israeli trauma. We're not talking about sharing neighborhoods. We're talking about separation. One of the reasons to have a Palestinian state in the West Bank and in Gaza is not to commingle, it's to separate, to come up with terms of separation. The Palestinians can realize some of their aspirations, but realize them separately. Any sort of coexistence of normalization may never happen, or if it were to happen, would happen far down the road. So this is not naivete. This is not asking people to forget about October 7th or decades of differences and violence. It's a way to basically preserve Israel as a secure, Jewish, democratic, prosperous state. Right now, all of that has been put at risk. This is not, you know, what I'm talking about is not simply a favor, or call it what you will, a gift to Palestinians. This is a gift Israelis can and should and must make to themselves.
Robin, I want to pick up on something Shibley talked about, which is the images that were coming out of Israel, out of Gaza, and the blowback to the United States. You know the region well. Do you think this is real? Is it something the United States should worry about?
The United States should worry very much about what the attitude is across the Arab world, given the fact that the Abraham Accords were the kind of groundwork of both Republican and Democratic administrations to expand Arab-Israeli relations, in part because they share a concern about the future with Iran in the region. But I think that, to Richard's point, the goal is clearly by the Biden administration to try to get the peace process back on track. The danger is that with every war, Israel turns further to the right. And that doesn't necessarily mean that Bibi Netanyahu stays around, but it does mean that peace is more difficult for Israelis, too, traumatized Israelis. I fear that we're further away from a revived peace process than at any time since 1993, 30 years since the Oslo Accords, and that the danger is that all the sides have very different goals. Hamas to destroy Israel, Israel to destroy Hamas. The United States hopes for a two-state solution that neither side is willing to discuss. And I think that the Israel-Saudi peace process or rapprochement was much further away, I've been told by people in the White House, than was widely assumed. Yes, it was on the table. Yes, there was interest. But there were an awful lot of specific details, including the fact that the United States was asked by the Saudis to provide basically the same kind of protection that it does with its NATO allies, including a nuclear umbrella. And that's a very controversial idea in the United States. So this war has now entered American politics, may play out in the election year. And remember, Presidents Reagan and Carter both were traumatized by hostage ordeals that affected their presidencies.
Robin Wright, thank you so much, as always. Richard, if you will stay with me, I want to talk about Ukraine, the other war that is going on that we really do have to get to. I also want to mention that Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog will join Wolf Blitzer for an exclusive interview today on Inside Politics. That's the next show up here on CNN at 11 a.m. This just into CNN, the Israeli Defense Forces say the Red Cross has received a handover of 17 Israeli and foreign hostages who were released from captivity in Gaza. We are back with Richard Haass. Richard, I want to just take you briefly to the other war that is ongoing in a brutal stalemate right now in Ukraine. And it feels to me like you have an important foreign affairs article. You're saying something similar to what you were just saying about U.S. strategy toward Israel. U.S. strategy towards Ukraine, you're saying, is publicly 100% supportive, but privately, we're very worried about where things are going. Why don't you set out what your concern is and where you want a kind of fairly substantial course correction?
Yeah, look, the idea is that Ukraine is on a course, hopefully, to liberate the 20% of its territory that Russia occupies. The problem, Fareed, is there's very little, if any, evidence that it's going to be able to achieve that. And I worry that Western American, European support for Ukraine will begin to fade. It's already happening. I worry about the cost to Ukraine. So what I am arguing is that Ukraine ought to switch its strategy, not give up on its long-term goals of getting back what's rightfully theirs, but to focus on defending what it has, on the 80%, making sure Russia cannot succeed in eliminating Ukraine, which is what it set out to do nearly 2 years ago. This would allow Ukraine to rebuild It would reduce the defense requirements from the United States and Europe. So I actually think it needs to recast its military strategy. And I'd make a larger point for you, and something you understand as well as anybody. Anytime in foreign policy there's a gap between your means and your ends, you run into trouble. The ends are laudable. They're just too ambitious right now. So I think Ukraine has to dial back. And the United States, just like we need to have some difficult conversations with Israel about what it's doing or not doing militarily and politically, I think the time has come for the United States to have some awkward but necessary conversations with Ukraine to basically say, we want you to survive. Let's recast your strategy. We will give you security assurances, but we have to put on the back burner your long-term goal of getting back all of your territory.
Very briefly, Richard, the one problem I sense in reading that article is Ukraine is not really viable right now as an economic entity without the ability to export its grain out of Odessa. You know, exporting by sea is much cheaper than by land. What, you know, shouldn't they fight at least to get control of Odessa?
Oh, I have no problem with that. And that could be the stipulation, that would be the point you'd have to get to, and then you would park it there. That would be the interim arrangement for it. That would make Ukraine economically viable, militarily secure, and that would become a plateau, not a permanent outcome, but a plateau until perhaps you have a different leadership in Russia that is tired about Russia being a pariah and being the target of economic sanctions.
Words of wisdom, as always, Richard. Thank you. Thanks to all of you for being part of my program this week. I will see you next week.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.